The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anoushka Astana. Theresa May heads to Brussels to try to break the Brexit deadlock. But back home, a growing chorus of Conservatives tell her, prepare to walk away with no deal. Labour says that would be catastrophic. We'll hear from Shadow Brexit Secretary Keir Starmer.
No deal is actually not viable, and those that are threatening it are, if you like, making an empty threat.
But Tory Brexiteer Charlie Elphick insists there is nothing to fear. We'll explore what no deal would look like and who would come off worse. Also this week, the high street gets political as fashion store Jigsaw launches a heart immigration campaign. We'll hear from the man behind it.
In order to emotionally engage with a brand now, people need to feel something.
And the pollster Bobby Duffy from Ipsos Mori on major new research into Britain's attitude towards immigration.
You can go all the way back to the 70s and still, even back then when net migration was effectively zero, two-thirds of people wanted immigration to be reduced.
Joining me for all of this, Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland, the director of the Resolution Foundation, Torsten Bell, and from Brussels, our deputy political editor, Rowena Mason. So, Rowena, you have followed the Prime Minister to Brussels, and the Prime Minister wants to move things on from divorce talk to the talk about a trade partnership. What are the main sticking points?
Well, there are three areas that the UK and EU has been allowed to discuss with the EU so far, according to the EU's terms. That's EU citizens' rights, Northern Ireland issues, and the financial settlement, i.e. how much money are we going to pay the EU as we come out? And it seems as though quite a lot of progress has been made on the first two issues. They seem to be quite close to a deal on citizens' rights and Northern Ireland. The main problem is that we are not offering as much money as the EU wants.
OK, and is there any hope of a breakthrough, in your opinion, at this council meeting?
I don't think so at this council meeting. They won't agree to talk about trade in the future relationship with the UK, but they'll do some preparatory work. And I imagine that Theresa May will spin this as a bit of a... she'll spin this in a positive way for Britain, in the sense that there has been some movement forward, but it's not huge movement forward. And of course, time is running out. If we want to get the trading relationship, the future relationship, nailed down before the exit date of March 2019.
Okay. And Johnny, don't ministers in the UK make a fair point that actually some of the issues that we're talking about, Northern Ireland in particular, but also the financial settlement, it's hard to get to a final decision on those things without moving on to trade talks. What is their problem? Why can't they move this on?
Well, it would be fine if those weren't the terms and the timetable that Britain had actually agreed to. I mean, we did accept that was the process it was going to have to be. And now that it's not working the way we want it to work, the government is saying, questioning the rules of a game they'd already started. So that's the problem. I think the desire they have is to somehow avoid the money being as central as it is. They want to sort of put that off because they know, Theresa May knows, that's a massive political price. That headline figure, when you finally have to admit it, when it's on the front of the Mail and front of the Express, that's a huge political hit. And we'll put it on the front too. But in terms of the Leave voting, Tory supporting papers, that is a massive climb down when that moment comes. And she wants to put that off and make sure that it is sugar-coated with some future deal that looks like that she's got the quid without the quo at the moment.
But while all this is going on, we're getting a clamour from Tory backbenchers and from some of the papers that you mentioned to be prepared to walk away. We are getting closer now, aren't we, to a situation where we'll end up with no deal.
Well, that is the really interesting thing. I mean, the one thing I really picked up loud and clear, particularly at the Tory party conference, was the actual appetite, the longing among delegates and the faithful for no deal. It is the harshest possible Brexit, and that's what they want. It wasn't seen as perhaps a necessary evil. It was seen as something positively to be desired. That's what I felt. And therefore, there's a kind of a sense where leaving the EU is not good enough. You've got to close the door. Closing the door is not good enough. You've got to slam the door. Slamming the door is not good enough. You've got to show two fingers on your way out. There is a sense among certain wing of that party that nothing is ever harsh enough. And that's what she's got caught on at the moment. It's got to be Brexit, you know, with added rudeness. Otherwise, it's not strong enough.
They might not put it like that, Torsten. But one thing might be fair to say is, what is the point of Brexiting if we don't go all out? If we're going to end up with a Norway-type deal, why did we go for it in the first place?
Well, you need to ask the British people. But I'm not sure I quite agree with Jonathan. I mean, what is obviously true is that there are chunks of the Conservative Party that are actively, a no deal is not a fallback, it's a first best outcome for some of them. But that is clearly not the government's position, and I believe them. It's not just that they're saying it's not their position, it's substantively, I think, for almost, or probably the entire government is not there, what they're looking for. And that, in the end, is one of the reasons why, although a no deal is clearly possible, it's both undesirable and pretty unlikely.
You say it's undesirable, and you really set that out in a report, the Resolution Foundation, this week. Just tell us what some of the things are that you have shown may happen under a no deal scenario.
Well, our report was on one very narrow, specific element of a no-deal situation, where the government has basically told us, were a no-deal situation to happen, which they tell us is better than a bad deal, that they would impose WTO tariffs on our relationship with the European Union. Most of that debate has focused on what that would mean for firms in the UK and for growth. The thing we looked at was actually what would it mean for consumers, for people in the UK, and what they buy. And because we'd be going for a situation where we pay no tariffs, we charge no tariffs on things being imported to the UK, to a situation where on some goods we were charging quite high tariffs, that would lead to price rises in the shops and would lead to a squeeze on incomes.
And what sort of reaction did you get to that?
Well, I mean, obviously we pointed out that we're an incredibly non-partisan organisation with and this is all through very technical models. I mean, people who want a no deal, they obviously don't want to hear things like that. Actually, I'd say people that are kind of dead against Brexit at any cost also wanted to say, oh my God, this is like, doesn't show that it's anywhere near as bad as it is. To which I say to both of them, this is a piece of an exercise looking at the specific effect of tariffs on the prices of goods. Really, what you people on the Remain side want to argue is, for lots of other reasons, you don't want no deal, to do with productivity, to do with our ongoing relationship. And you on the other side, no deal is, if you're honest, probably think that this is a price worth paying.
So, Rowena, interestingly, I was asking Torsten about the backlash, because this week the OECD came out pretty negatively about the idea of Brexit going ahead, suggested that if we reversed it, it would be good for the economy. And it triggered somewhat of a backlash. Do you think people are a little afraid of speaking out in a anti-Brexit way at the moment?
Well, there are some sort of conservatives in the middle of the party that don't quite know, they're not quite brave enough to come out with their real worries about Brexit. I think that's true. But there is certainly a very vocal caucus on the kind of soft Tory, centrist Tory section of the party, the Anna Soubrys, the Nicky Morgan, the Dominic Greaves, who are really making life as difficult as possible for May by putting forward all these arguments against no deal and for a soft Brexit. So really the Prime Minister is caught between these sort of two opposing factions of her party.
A one rock and a hard place, some might say.
Well, quite. One of them was fighting for a very hard Brexit, genuinely, as Johnny was saying, and the other half is fighting for a very soft Brexit. And you can see that going right through the middle of the party and right from the grassroots up to cabinet level. You have, I mean, Torsten saying that almost all the government does want a deal. I mean, that's true, but there are some in the cabinet that would be really very fine with no deal at all. I'm thinking of Liam Fox, probably Boris Johnson. On the other side, you've got Philip Hammond, the Chancellor, and some of his colleagues who want to stay as close to the EU as possible in order to try and protect the economy.
I think Rowena is completely right about that. And there are these two camps, and you can see the Liam Fox sort of no deal position. And they're backed this week by, you know, John Redwood, Owen Paterson, Nigel Lawson, a whole lot of grandees who also want no deal. My only point was, if you look at the history of Europe as this issue that divides the Tory party, it is always one side that wins in the end. It is the loudest, most Eurosceptic, most Europhobic faction that win out. So right now it looks as if there isn't a majority where it matters for no deal. But you look at the past and how they always manage to drag reluctant prime ministers to their side, and you think that's where the energy is. And that's my point about the Tory conference. It wasn't cabinet ministers or MPs. It was the energy in the movement, if you like, the Tory family. They want no deal and they tend to get their way.
Well, I think, can I just offer a contrasting argument for how we've got to where we've got to on? So the weird thing that's happened the last 10 days, as Rory and others have said, is that no deal is like, feels like it's back on the table in a way it wasn't like even like 3 weeks ago. The one reading of that, and you had like JP Morgan saying, with their made up percentages, saying it's gone from 15 to 25%. Now, they were wrong when they said 15, they're wrong when they said 25, but the direction of travel is the point. And one reading of that is that that this is about the dynamics within the Conservative Party. And clearly, across all of politics at the moment, with a small majority, that is what is going on. But I would say that no deal is actually back on the table because of the structure of the negotiations, which is because once we've triggered Article 50, we've got this ludicrous situation of the people you're negotiating with setting the terms of the negotiations and the timetable being fixed. The reason no deal reemerges is because that is a hard situation to be in. And it's that structure that is driving back up the agenda.
And just before we move on to some MPs on either side of this debate, Rowena, seeing as we've talked about both Boris Johnson and Philip Hammond, what do you think the chances are that they will still be in their jobs in a few weeks? And also, as someone who's seen the Prime Minister close up, we're talking about the fight in the Tory family. Where do you think her heart is?
I think her heart probably remains much the same place as it did before the referendum, which is that she's not particularly theologically wedded to either side, but pragmatically, she thinks that on balance, it's not a good idea to leave the EU. And we saw her the other day in an LBC radio interview, not able to say that she would vote for Brexit if there was another referendum tomorrow. And that was something that really inflamed the Eurosceptic right of her party. So she's, in a way, although she's coming in for a lot of criticism from both sides of her party, she is actually holding it together in a sense, because she has, you know, she's able to say to both sides that she's listening to them. If you're thinking about a reshuffle, it's very difficult for her now to sack either Philip Hammond or Boris Johnson without sacking the other one. It's become kind of symbolic of the wider fight over Brexit within the party. So if she were to sack Philip Hammond, the Remainers would be absolutely up in arms. And if she were to sack Boris Johnson, the Eurosceptics would see that as a betrayal of their aims.
Okay.
So she could only be, you know, she could sack both of them, or she could, in her weakened position,
who'd be Theresa May,
them where they are and move some of the more minor players around to try and promote some young, fresh talent.
The rumour is that both will go, but I think she's going to end up with some problems on the backbenches if she did that. Well, look, it's not only the Tory family that are having this argument, the Labour family are too. And earlier I caught up with the shadow Brexit secretary, Keir Starmer.
There's a lot of talk now that we could be heading towards no deal with the European Union. It feels like a lot of Conservative MPs would actually quite like that. Labour's position on this is that you would reject that at any cost?
Yes, we've got no truck with those that are talking up no deal or even casual about no deal. No deal literally means we've not agreed on anything. Not just that we haven't agreed on trade, but that we haven't agreed what should happen in Northern Ireland at the border. That makes it inevitable you'd have to have a border. We've not agreed on EU nationals here or UK nationals in Europe. We haven't agreed on the rules for aviation. And we haven't got a substitute set of arrangements for security and counter-terrorism. So no deal is actually not viable. And those that are threatening it are, if you like, making an empty threat. And therefore, we've always said the government should focus on getting a deal and getting, more importantly at this stage, transitional arrangements on the same basic terms. Because even a deal is unachievable in the period that there is left of the Article 50 negotiations.
And you say that, but a lot of people would say that negotiating tactics mean you have to be prepared to walk away. Otherwise, in the end, they won't bend to any of our demands.
Well, I'm bemused by this argument that if you threaten to jump over a cliff, then that is a good negotiating tactic. Going over the cliff is what will happen in March 2019 if we have not reached an agreement. We are going over that cliff. And these are unlike other negotiations. Normally, if you negotiate from the position you're in. And if you don't reach an agreement, you're in the same position you're in the first place. And therefore, you could say, well, we've lost nothing by not making this agreement. This is the complete opposite. We're in an agreement, and we are negotiating to get out of the agreement. So the one thing that will not happen in March 2019 is the status quo. And I think a number of people are getting into their mind that somehow no deal simply means we carry on pretty much as we are now.
And Labour's position very clear then, no to no deal in terms of the divorce proceedings, so the Northern Irish border, the money, the question of EU citizens. What if we have an agreement there, but we are not able to strike a trade deal with the EU?
Well, that would be a very serious situation as well. You've only got to run through the tariffs, whether it's in agriculture, meat products, clothing, textiles or cars, to see what an impact that would have on our economy. And I think there'll be a crisis of confidence in the economy. We set out red lines earlier this year as to the financial deal, or the trade deal, if you like, and we'll stick to those red lines. And we've always indicated that if they're not met, if those tests are not met, then we will not vote in favour of the government's deal.
And just finally, can you explain to our listeners, if we reach October 2018, you don't like what you see, the Labour Party, perhaps with some Tory rebels, votes against the government on Brexit, what happens then? Surely there isn't time then to go back to the table. Doesn't that mean that we could crash out?
That's complete failure. That is complete failure by the government in its negotiating if we've reached that position. We asked for a vote before the European Parliament votes on Article 50, precisely because we want time for the Prime Minister to go back. So to some extent, it depends when she comes back with a deal or without a deal. But the consequences are going to be really serious. And if the House of Commons does not have confidence in what the Prime Minister brings back, that is a very serious situation for the Prime Minister to find herself in.
But what happens in that situation? Imagine by spring 2019, we don't have confidence in what the Prime Minister has said. What happens then? Can Article 50 be stopped?
Well, it seems to me it's very, for a Prime Minister to say, I brought back a deal, it's the best deal I can put before you, and Parliament rejects it. For the Prime Minister to simply then say, well, I'm going to press on regardless, is untenable. She will have to reflect on what are all of the options available to her at that stage.
General election, a referendum?
I'm not going to speculate, but I don't underestimate how serious a situation that presents to the Prime Minister.
And just finally, you say no deal would be catastrophic for the UK. How bad would it be for the EU?
It would be very bad for the EU. And in all my discussions with other EU countries, leaders and politicians, not one of them from any other EU country has said that no deal is good for them. And that's why I've said on a number of occasions that moving on now swiftly and urgently requires action not only from our own government, but also from the EU. It's in both of our interests to get a deal.
Keir Starmer, thank you very much. So I've left Portcullis House and I'm now up with the Dover MP, Charlie Elphick, who campaigned for Remain, am I right in saying, but is now really wanting to push ahead with Brexit. Charlie, you're an officer of the European Research Group, which is the group of Conservative MPs, essentially saying that Brexit has to happen now, and presumably whether there's a deal or not.
That's right. Look, you know, we had a referendum. The British people were really clear in their decision. I argued that we should remain. That was not the decision the British people took. We need to respect the referendum and make a success of it.
And in particular, you've talked about Dover and the ports in Dover, through which the vast majority of trade runs on lorries through this country. I think I'm right in saying has to have infrastructure changes if it's to prepare for no deal. That's not happening, is it?
Well, that's right. I've been very clear that we should be, you know, ready on day one, prepared for every eventuality, deal or no deal. Obviously, we all hope for a deal, but the way things are going, with demands that we simply sign a blank check for the possibility of discussions, doesn't look very promising. And that's why I've been making the case that we need to invest now so that we have the option of being able to walk away from the table if we're pressed too hard.
So how worried are you that the Chancellor doesn't seem prepared to invest now?
Well, I think the Prime Minister in Prime Minister's questions was very clear that we were investing. I think she's taking the right decision. Because anyone knows, if you're in a negotiation, if you have to do the deal and you can't walk away from the table, the price is going to go up and the terms are going to get worse. And so that's why I'm saying we need to put ourselves in a position where we can get up from the table and we can walk away. And I think once the European side knows that that's a possibility, we can start getting a sensible deal. And I hope that common sense will prevail all around and will continue the flow of seamless traffic across the channel.
But what Labour would argue is, A, it's an empty threat, and B, it would be catastrophic for the UK to not have a deal, because a deal, for example, would settle the question in Northern Ireland, it would settle the question for EU citizens in this country, and it would require a financial settlement by which we actually go through the divorce procedure.
But the British people are quite clear in that they're simply not prepared to sign a blank cheque. Labour say they would sign a blank cheque. They would just write out a cheque for £100 billion. This is hard-earned taxpayers' money, and that's why the Prime Minister is right to stand up for the national interest.
Charlie Elphick, and before him, Labour's Keir Starmer. So, Rowena, one thing that I think is quite interesting is that Keir Starmer there was very clearly talking about what some would say is the divorce agreement, suggesting that no deal would mean that we don't have security cooperation and we haven't solved the Northern Ireland border issue. When Brexiteers speak, I get the impression that they're talking more about the trading arrangement. Do you think that they just assume a divorce agreement will be achieved?
I think that we don't quite know what the EU will allow. And so if you're talking technically, then no deal. Sure, that means not only no deal on trade, it means no deal on security, it means no deal on citizens' rights, it means no deal on Northern Ireland, something that sounds really, really serious on lots of fronts. It also means things like no deal on aviation, which would mean that planes are being not taking off. So, I mean, that what the Brexiters on the other side of the argument say is, of course, nobody will allow that to happen. You can sign a bit of paper on aviation to say things will just carry on as they were. And they, you know, and the same goes for things like security cooperation. So, yes, I think you're right that when they're talking about no deal, what they want ideally is looser trade ties with the EU. They basically would be quite happy to move to WTO terms for trading.
OK. And Torsten, if they did that, obviously you've looked at one specific area. How damaging do you think it would be, and who would be most hurt, Britain or the rest of the EU?
Well, everyone would be hurt a lot, is the answer. And that's why, in the end, it's very quite unlikely to happen. On the wider question of what is a no deal, I think I agree with you that it's not credible that all these other elements, where there is basically agreement across the parties in the negotiations, won't happen. And clearly, those will start getting ticked through when the grandstanding on the other issues has come forward. So the issue really is, and I think it's less actually about, I think the really underpinning thing here is less about whether the Brexiteers want to have tariffs versus the EU, because most of these people are anti-tariffs with everybody. They just want to get rid of all tariffs. It's more to do with, are they prepared to accept regulatory convergence after, or at least minimum regulatory standards, which obviously to lots of people in the Brexiteer movement looks like staying in bits of the EU. That's really what the row is about. And they think that no deal on trade is the safest way to get to that long-term outcome, where they'll then get rid of their tariffs and do that. Now, on who loses out most, I mean, on the tariff question, people that lose out are lower-income families who the goods that they consume more of as a percentage of their overall consumption, such as clothing and food, would be the areas where tariff changes would be the most
worse
impactful.
In the UK or worse for people in the EU?
We've not looked at the impact on people in the EU. I mean, obviously, in absolute terms, the impact of tariffs on British goods into the EU for EU consumers would be less, because the amount of British things they consume is much lower than the proportion that we consume. We're smaller than the EU is, so you can do the maths.
The other thing that was worth mentioning is that there are Labour people too who have embraced not no deal, not at all, but the idea of no deal being on the agenda, simply because that is doing what Project Fear never quite did, which it is terrifying people. And therefore there are some who quite like no deal being in the air, because no deal might lead to no Brexit. And so you're getting people thinking the more people talk up no deal, the more people might start saying, and there was this YouGov poll that got people excited, in which, you know, Leave being wrong was 5 points ahead of Leave being right for the first time. There are people who begin to think maybe the British electorate will recoil the more they hear about this and say, let's not even go there at all.
Do you believe there's a chance that that would happen, and that you know, a political force bigger enough, and I guess that would have to be the Labour Party, would embrace that?
Well, that, I think, you know, you've put your finger on it. There would have to be a change in Labour. And Labour has moved inch by inch from a position where on the morning of the referendum, it was Jeremy Corbyn who said, let's trigger Article 50 now, on June the 24th. They've moved from there to now saying, you know, this 2 to 4 year transition period, the kind of thing that Keir Starmer, who we just heard, pushed and pushed and pushed to get them into that position. And what people tell me is that journey isn't over yet. You know, there is still pushing going. So if the numbers, the polling numbers, and particularly among younger people and people who now Labour regards as core parts of its electoral base, begin to say, you know, we don't want to do this, and the numbers look healthy enough, then you could imagine Jeremy Corbyn, who I think has got to shifted into now a more pragmatic position where he wants to be prime minister, wants to win. If he thinks that's the way to win, then who knows? You know, this thing is fluid, but it's just interesting. You've got outriders on the right, John Redwood and that lot pushing no deal, but it's not uncommon to hear sort of Chukwuemeka type people, I haven't heard it from him, but talking up no deal because they think it might almost frighten the horses into saying, what about no Brexit?
And just finally on that point, Rowena, Theresa May is not the only person in town. Jeremy Corbyn is there too. How embarrassing is that for Theresa May, that Jeremy Corbyn is actually meeting other EU leaders? And I understand that he got a bit of a hero's welcome from socialists in Europe, where he went to tell them that actually everyone had said that he had no chance and he had started to prove people wrong.
I mean, it's quite a clever move. Colleagues tell me that he's actually done more, he's done quite a few low-key visits out to the Brussels at the time of the European Councils in the past, but he's been making much more of a big deal of it this time. And he's got this this key meeting with Michel Barnier and several heads of European states. So he's making more of a splash. He's looking to appear more prime ministerial, and he's trying to position himself as somebody who is ready and willing to take over the Brexit negotiations if the Conservatives fall out of power.
Well, you can follow all our reporting on Brexit at theguardian.com/politics. Now, billboards around London's Oxford Street have been adorned with the slogan Heart Immigration, as part of a new campaign from the high street retailer Jigsaw. It's rare for brands to move explicitly into the sphere of politics, and especially on an issue so charged. Earlier this week, I sat down with the man behind the campaign, Jigsaw's marketing director, Alex Kelly.
We wanted to go out and make a statement. It's something that we have done in the past with our campaigns. We have a brand ethos called Style and Truth, and we produce campaigns that make a statement which is either a reflection on the current environment and society we're in, or us as a brand, or our viewpoint on the fashion industry. So we tend to swim in the opposite direction a little bit and give people something to think about that perhaps other fashion brands might not say.
Okay, and immigration in particular, what statement are you trying to make around it?
So immigration, we sat around the room and we talked about our next campaign and how we could get people to start to think about what was going on in the world at the moment, and we reflected on Brexit and some of the viewpoints that were coming out as a result of that, but not precisely Brexit and the political statements around it. And we felt that immigration was a word that had been demonised slightly, and we felt that there was no one else that was really talking about the benefits that that brought to our society in the broader context, as well as to us as a fashion brand. And we came up with this Heart Immigration campaign as a way, really, of pointing out that our collections come from all over the world. We work with about 16 different countries to produce our collections, and also as a reflection of the 45 different nationalities that design, produce, work on, market, myself, and sell our collections to our consumers. So it was about immigration in its broadest sense, rather than just immigration policy or all the commentary that's been going on recently around the political arena.
And it's a kind of thorny issue, and it's a quite difficult issue to get into, but you're celebrating the fact that you hire people from all over the world. People here might think, why don't you hire more people from Britain? Is there a risk that you actually alienate people through something like this?
Potentially, but I think consumers are quite tired of that vanilla approach from brands. That bit in the middle is very safe and it's occupied by many people. And I think that in order to emotionally engage with a brand now, people need to feel something. There is a chance, yes, that they might not agree with you, but I think it's a risk worth taking in order to emotionally connect to consumers. And I think, when you boil it down, the message that we're actually saying is quite obvious and very palatable. What we're saying is that we agree with a multicultural and diverse Britain and that actually some of the greatest things that influence us as a brand come from outside of this country.
And I know you've got posters in Oxford Street in London, which is extremely multicultural and was also where the Remain vote was perhaps highest in the country. In some of the areas of the country where the Brexit vote was very high, perhaps because of worries about immigration, places like Peterborough or Mansfield, places in the northeast. I mean, how strongly are you advertising up there?
Well, we're not in all of those areas that you've spoken about. We're not necessarily advertising, mostly because I don't have the budget to. I would love to have huge budgets and to have plastered it more broadly. The response has been fantastic. There are some environments where perhaps that immigration word is more thorny, as you say. And for me, as a brand and a marketeer, it's about aligning with our customer base. So our stores aren't necessarily placed in some of those environments. But the campaign is digital, and we've seen such a huge response to the campaign that the media positioning, if you like, has far extended the reach of London. It's in that digital social sphere, and you know, one of the tweets, for example, has been reposted over 10,000 times. So it's very difficult to calculate the reach of that, but it definitely extends to beyond some of the environments where you might expect us to place that campaign. And we weren't afraid of that debate. I mean, it was something that we wanted to encourage. Our customers are intelligent. They're definitely opinionated. We know that. And we wanted to provide a platform which allowed for intelligent debate around the subject of immigration and highlighting some of the wonderful things that it has done for our culture.
Alex Kelly of Jigsaw there. Now this week, the polling firm Ipsos Mori released a new report, Shifting Ground, on Britain's changing attitudes to immigration. The work is a longitudinal study based on monitoring the same group of people over time, and it has some fascinating insights. I'm joined on the line now by Bobby Duffy, Managing Director of Ipsos Mori Social Research Institute. So, interesting research from Ipsos Mori, and I was quite struck by a finding that I guess we think about, but we didn't actually know, that the Brexit vote was driven by views on immigration.
Yes, definitely. That was the clear, most important issue when we do kind of basic analysis, but then when you do more sophisticated analysis to try to separate different issues out to say what is the most important, it was clearly that anti-immigrant and nativist sentiment.
And you talk about a certain sense of nostalgia rather than necessarily being driven by economic concerns.
Yeah, I think this is a really key point, is the balance between whether this is an economically driven issue, anti-immigrant sentiment, and Brexit vote, or more about cultural concern. And it's clearly a mix of both, but I think the discussion has quite often overemphasized the economic aspect of it's about being left behind or not having opportunities. But the analysis shows that if any, there is a mix of both, but if anything's dominant, it's more the cultural aspects of this. And then in some ways, actually, that's related to underlying values more than something that shifts with opinion. So this is much more revealing an underlying sentiment of concern about change and what our country is, rather than something that's created. So it's quite long-standing. You can see that in when you look back at the history of attitudes on this, that you can go all the way back to the 70s, and still, even back then, when net migration was effectively zero, two-thirds of people wanted immigration to be reduced.
And if this is almost a human instinct, I mean, we see, for example, headlines in some of the newspapers were quite similar about Russian immigration and Jewish immigration at the start of the century, as it later was about, you know, the Windrush generation. I know as an Indian in the 80s, it was people like us who were seen as the other. That might have changed to refugees in the late 90s. Now it's Eastern Europeans. Does this mean that Brexit isn't actually going to solve any problem?
Yeah, well, your point is exactly right about the history of this. You can go back through all periods of history and find that similar sorts of concern about people coming in and the pace of change and what that means for the country. And that does imply that it's going to take an awful lot to reassure people on this. I think that there's different attitudes and different questions that we ask on this, because that is just about whether you want numbers to go up and down, and that's that. I think that is a sort of human instinctive thing about a sense of fear of change. But we have already seen some changes in this study and others of how people view immigration. So we've seen a big shift to people admitting or feeling that immigration has a positive impact on the country. So we just did an international study where Britain used, this is across 25 countries, Britain used to be quite near the bottom of thinking immigration is positive. Now we're third from the top. We've gone from just 19% of people thinking that immigration is a positive, has a positive impact on Britain, to over 40% now.
And that's higher than the numbers who think it has a negative impact.
That's right. So it's in the net positive. And that kind of switched over. That was from 2011, that trend, but it kind of switched over just before Brexit and then increased the increased positive view post-Brexit. So that's really interesting. And why is that? And I think it's probably a mix of things, of people who are galvanized, who are already fairly positive, galvanized to say they are positive because of Brexit, that they think they should speak out about that more. But it's also probably a sense of reassurance from those who are actually want immigration numbers to be reduced, and they expect Brexit may help deliver that. And now they feel they're better able to admit that actually there's some positive aspects of immigration.
Okay, and talking about polarisation, I must finally ask you about a little chart that I saw you tweeted that looked at people who read different newspapers and their views about immigration. How did we fare at The Guardian, and how do we compare to other newspapers?
Guardian readers are maybe not surprisingly the least worried about immigration when you ask what's the most important issue facing Britain. A very low level of concern among Guardian readers. And then at the other end of the scale, you've got Express and Mail readers. And there's one of the biggest gaps between any groups, between that top and bottom. And the interesting thing is the people who don't read newspapers, and the kind of average is exactly between those two. So Guardian readers are just as far from the average as the Express readers are in the other direction.
Bobby Duffy of Ipsos Mori, thank you very much. Johnny, I'm really interested in what's happening in the Labour Party when it comes to immigration. Straight after the referendum, when so many Labour constituencies voted to leave, there was a sense from very prominent voices in the party that immigration was the most important thing that had to be solved. These days, the more prominent thing we hear from the backbenches is we need to try and stay inside the single market, which in itself means free movement would have to be compromised on. What has caused that shift?
Well, there are, I think both are still there. So you still have a Caroline Flint type voice, which says, my constituents voted to leave, they expect us to leave, and they did it because of migration. And you have other people around, you know, who suggest that any staying in the single market long term would have to be predicated on some compromise, some qualification, modification on free movement. And Jeremy Corbyn himself did say that, you know, free movement in the sense that it had undercut British workers, you know, they were going to deal with that, which was his first stepping back from a kind of absolute position on free movement. So both camps are there. There are these tensions. The reason why we feel it's less sort of vicious a fight than it was is because the election result made them want to fall in behind the leader, and so unity has broken out a bit. But the argument is still there on immigration. I think the other thing that's interesting with these poll numbers is a sense, and you have a version of this a bit in Labour too, that people feel as if that they have got this issue out of their system in a way by voting leave. So the salience, the kind of heat, has gone out of the issue because people have had their say on it. And I think that's allowed some space for people to make the positive case for immigration, to realise that actually we get things from new arrivals coming into this country, because the sense that this was an issue that was being repressed, and that the establishment won't listen to us on it, it hasn't gone away, but it has, some of the sting has gone out of that, I think.
And interesting, Torsten, from the research, I mean, do you think that the election result, in which Jeremy Corbyn, while he did say he would end free movement, essentially suggested that immigration numbers may not change very much under a Labour government, do you think that he showed, by winning 40% of the electorate over, that immigration is not as big an issue as it may have been a year ago?
No, I don't think the general election result shows that in any major way. I mean, I think what I do think is changing. I mean, the relationship with the Labour Party to migration as an issue and to the single market is a really interesting case study in political time inconsistency, i.e. whatever feels like it's the biggest problem at the time drives your position, even if it involves trails to other positions which you do really care about. So, for example, after the Brexit referendum, although most Labour MPs had obviously backed Remain and were very depressed, it had done one very weird thing, which it had taken off the table the issue that was the biggest doorstep problem for them. They could not answer the question, yes, you want to stay in the EU, but why can't we have some limit on the level of migration. And because they couldn't answer that, and they couldn't answer in the referendum or in the 2015 general election, that was a problem. Working people were asking for it, and the Labour Party couldn't say that they could give it to them, and that was a big problem. Brexit, for whatever, wherever they thought substantively, removed that as a political problem. Then what happens a year on, everybody's kind of breathed their sigh of relief on migration. The migration problem for Labour to some degree has been solved, and actually obviously numbers start ticking down, which is probably more of a substance issue. But then what happens is the single market and staying in it now becomes the really hot issue, and MPs want to be able to say, I think we should stay in the single market and Theresa May will take us out. Then they kind of say in brackets, well, you obviously wouldn't have complete free movement, but we might have something. This is, you know, as always, we've got a cake and eat it situation, and you want your cake when the cake issue seems to be the big issue of the day, and you want to get on with eating it when eating is the issue of the day, and that is what's happening amongst Labour MPs now.
And Rowena, do you think there's any chance that free movement could be reformed while we remain within the single market, or is that just simply nothing that the EU would ever offer? And just in negotiation terms, I do get the impression that some in the Labour Party would like to see a fair system between the EU and non-EU countries. Is there any chance that we can end up with a decent trade arrangement without giving preference to EU workers?
Okay, so on the first one, David Cameron tried really, really hard to get this during his renegotiations, if you remember them, before the EU referendum, and didn't seem to make much headway on it. I mean, it's always possible that the EU could shift some ground on that, but you can't really rely on it. You can't really kind of form a political strategy in the UK based on the hope that that's what the rest of Europe is going to do. So I think the situation we're in at the moment is that both parties are preparing their own immigration systems for a post-Brexit world, which comes on to the second question, which is about whether we could have a system where there is parity between EU citizens and non-EU citizens. But I think from Labour's point of view, they're not too fussed about bringing numbers down, because what they're going to do is argue that it's about control and it's about, you know, it's about designing your own system. And so if they had a fairly liberal immigration system for both EU citizens and non-EU citizens, it is possible to see how you could square that off with what the rest of Europe wants.
Fantastic. Well, I will let you, Rowena, go and chase down the Prime Minister. Thank you all very much. Well, we'll link to that Ipsos Mori research on our podcast page, as well as that Resolution Foundation report. But that is all we have time for this week. My thanks to Torsten Bell, Jonathan Friedland and Rowena Mason. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anushka Astana. Thanks for listening.